Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I am your co-host, Judy Alexander, here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Hello, Judy, and hello, everyone listening. And our topic for today is?
It is the death spiral for passion.
Ooh, that sounds kind of dire, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Cueing the ominous music right now. It's really not that dire, and you know, we're going to be pretty brief talking about it today because we have a special treat for today's podcast. We have an interview coming up with Dr. Batsheva Marcus, and we'll do a more complete introduction of her in a little while, but she is known in a New York Times article, they called her the Orthodox Jewish sex guru. So you're in for a real treat. We've already done the recording and you'll get to hear it in just a little while. And it fits perfectly with this particular topic. This topic is the next chapter in my book, Reigniting the Spark. The death spiral for passion is a normal process. I say normal in the sense of it happens to your typical couple. You know, if you're together long enough, that possibility that people will be so careful about not rocking the boat, about not disturbing stability, as we talked about in some past podcasts, that they'll have a tendency to shut down intimacy because it can be a little scary to raise, you know, issues about, gee, maybe I'd like to try something different in bed, or maybe I'm just not happy with how something is going. And anything like that can cause your partner some anxiety and cause yourself some anxiety. And so people tend to avoid that. And that's what I describe in the book as the death spiral for passion.
I think that in our discussions with Batsheva, this is a great subject for her because, as Bruce said, she is known as the sex guru. And she has a different take on passion. Well, not so much a different take, but she looks at it more holistically. And I think you'll enjoy the interview very much.
Absolutely. And, you know, we talk about that some in the interview, how she provided a point of view that was so helpful to me in broadening my own outlook and actually made pretty significant changes in the book as a result of her help.
But we don't want to give away too much, so why don't we go to our interview segment and hear what Batsheva has to say?
Let's do that. And so we now turn to our interview with Dr. Batsheva Marcus.
We're delighted to have as our guest today Dr. Batsheva Marcus. Dr. Marcus is founder and clinical director of Mays Women's Sexual Health in New York City, the largest independent sexual health center in the United States. In a 2015 profile of her work, the New York Times Magazine called her the Orthodox Sex Guru. She is passionate about women finding the pleasure of being alive through their sexuality, and her book on the subject, Sex Points, will be published next March. Dr. Marcus is one of the founders of JOFA, the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance. Dr. Marcus is also co-host of The Joy of Text, a podcast about Judaism, sexuality, and the intersection of the two. Batsheva, welcome to our podcast.
It is such a joy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, we are thrilled. And let me just start in. A lot of our listeners might find the whole idea of an Orthodox Jewish sex guru surprising or maybe even incongruous, just as they might find the idea of an Orthodox Jewish feminist surprising or incongruous. Do you experience conflicts between your orthodoxy and your feminism in general and your passion about women finding sexual pleasure in particular? And how does your experience of orthodoxy support your feminism and your sex positivity?
Oh my God, Judy, that's one question. That's like six questions.
We'll get you going here.
Where do we start? Where do you want to start? Do you want to start with the feminism or do you want to start with the sex?
Well, why don't we start with your feminism and then we'll lead up to sex. How about that?
Yeah. So, would I say that my orthodoxy and my feminism are in conflict? I would say absolutely. Yes, they are. I would be lying if I said otherwise. But I also feel like part of the fun of life or part of the challenge of life is taking things that you love that may not always seem like they work in consonance and getting to a place where you feel like you can live with both of them. So I am a feminist. Like, I will never be anything but a feminist. I really do believe women being able to do whatever they want, whenever they want, and not being constrained by unnecessary societal constraints. I also love Orthodox Judaism. I grew up in Orthodox Judaism. There's just so much that I love about it, with the community and the power of connection and the holidays and the rituals. So it became my sort of a big piece of my life's work to figure out where I can fit those two together. And it has been a challenge. And I feel like for many, many years, less recently, but many, many years, I spent a lot of my communal energy working on finding the balance between the two. And sometimes that felt like really asking the difficult questions, like, what are the restraints on women? Are they actually religious constraints that come from Jewish law? Or are they actually just societal norms that the Orthodox community has gotten used to? And if it's the latter, then maybe we can sort of jettison them. And if it's the former, and there are some that are the former, then how do I personally reconcile those? I have to struggle with that, as we all do. You know, nothing is perfect.
Sure. So it sounds like you probably have had to educate your community a lot, I would think. Yes?
Yes. I think the community has changed dramatically since I was a little girl. Dramatically. Like, I think the community may not realize it did, but in terms of the inclusion of women in rituals, women saying Kaddish, you know, women saying the rituals for parents who have passed away or family members who have passed away, rituals of, you know, Shabbat, including women in sort of rituals has really changed. Girls' bat mitzvahs, that was not a thing at all when I was growing up, believe it or not, in the ancient history. The community has changed a lot. And so I think the community has shifted and I've shifted.
And I think for the benefit of our listeners, we can maybe situate you in the modern Orthodox world. I'd actually like to ask you, because I know one of the populations you work with, in addition to, you work with people across the spectrum, as I understand it, in terms of their culture.
Most of our practice is not Jewish, you know, certainly not Jews who are observant, but a small population are, I think, where you're going with this, right?
Yeah, you can, indeed, you can guess. Yeah, because you are also well known for, that's what they were writing about, I think, in the New York Times profile a few years ago. You're known for working with people in the Satmar community, in the what sometimes people refer to as the ultra-Orthodox community. And that's, I know, fascinating to a lot of people. Could you comment on some of that? How, or maybe more generally, how does your understanding of your own faith fit in your work with people across a wide spectrum, including people in the ultra-Orthodox community?
So that's an amazing question, and it's one I sort of think about a lot, obviously. Yes, I personally am situated in the modern Orthodox community, but I think my familiarity with the Orthodox community's rituals and texts puts me in a really excellent position to work with the women who are in the more, let's call them conservative small c or ultra-Orthodox communities, because they know that I start with a level of understanding of where they're coming from and respect. And it's a respect I struggle with, to be honest with you. It's hard for me sometimes when I see women being put in positions that I feel like are not good for them. And there's where the feminism comes in. I try to work with them. You know, I feel like in general, as therapists, you guys can certainly get this. If you want to be able to be culturally sensitive, you have to put your own values sort of at the door to a certain degree and really try to work with the client and figure out where they want to end up. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm seeing an ultra-Orthodox woman who is, let's say, for example, pretty clear that she's primarily interested in women and not men, like we would think of them as lesbians, but she's got three kids and moving out of that community into a lesbian relationship would mean giving up her children. That's really not an option that she's willing to entertain. You know, I can put it on the table just so that she knows that should she decide to go there, we can talk about it. But I also know that my work with her is going to be respecting the choices she's made in her life and trying to help her live the best life she can given that.
You probably saw or read the book Unorthodox. Sounds a little bit like that scenario.
I read the book. It was not a fan of the book. Saw the TV show or the film, got, if I say 1,000, I mean, I've never gotten so many inquiries after that.
I'll bet.
I did a live on Instagram on that, which was
Saw that, yeah. We've heard you interviewed on the subject, yeah.
And, you know, it's complicated because I feel like in a lot of ways it was a very real representation of that community. I feel like a lot of people were very put off by that. And like any other community, it's such a broad spectrum. And it took me a long time to kind of realize that also. It took me, I would say, a couple of years in working with that community to realize how broad, like I'll have some patients who come in who like will not do anything without talking to their rabbi, their husband, and thus their, and then their rabbi. And mm-hmm. I'll have other people from the exact same community who are like, just give me the books, give me the vibrators, give me whatever you want to give me. It's fine. So I shouldn't have been surprised, right? Because in the end, people are people. And that's true in my community. It's probably true in your community. I guess I didn't expect it in this community that there's such a wide range, but there is. So that show showed one particular family approach. It's not crazy. You see it. I've seen a lot of it. But it's not necessarily representative of the whole community. And I feel like that's important for people to realize.
Yeah, it is interesting when you're talking about working with, of course, not just that community, but people all across that spectrum of, you know, Jewish, not Jewish, and all sorts of different ways, even among the Jewish people, different ways of expressing their Judaism. We all have to start with clients where they are. And that idea that says, yeah, I have my own values and my own faith and my own sense of how I do this work, but I really have to meet people where they are. And I think in a lot of ways, that's a very Jewish perspective anyway. You know, the Talmud is full of arguments and respect for varying views, even on those relatively rare occasions where they come down on one side of something and say, no, this is absolutely the way to do it. There's still respect for the other points of view. Do you find that that is part of how your work is influenced by your Judaism?
My work is definitely influenced by my Judaism, my openness to others' values. I'm not sure. It is true. You're right. The Talmud is very varied in its opinions. It could also be extremely narrow in terms of cutting off the legitimacy of other opinions. So I'm very much of the belief that people say, like, what does Judaism say about this? And I just laugh because Judaism says 20 things about everything. So there's no one perspective. I hope that my Judaism has softened me up to understand different cultures. I will say for sure one thing, which is that Judaism, the laws regarding sex in the Orthodox community are so dramatic, let's use that word, and so extreme in some ways, even in the modern Orthodox community, that it certainly has made me more sensitive to the fact that culturally, other people's ideas about sex, there's almost nothing that can compete in terms of being complicated and involved and minutiae. And so for sure, my understanding of Judaism and sexuality and my thinking about that has made me very, very sensitive culturally to other issues around sex and other cultures and religions.
What would be an example of some of those minutiae that, you know, sort of you're referring to?
Well, women who consider themselves observant from the time they get their period, from, you know, every month, from the time they get their period, they will separate physically from their husband, partner. And depending on how religious you are, not even that, you know, you don't have to go to the ultra Orthodox community to find people who just don't touch each other, don't sleep in the same bed. And that's for 12 days, a minimum of five days of menstruation, and then 7 days of what they call non-bleeding or clean days, where you examine yourself for 7 days, do an internal exam, make sure that there's no blood. At the end of that, you go to a ritual bath. Mm-hmm. There's so many laws about what that ritual bath needs to be like and how it has to be built. And when women use the ritual bath, how they have to clean themselves and make sure there's nothing between them and the water. Mm-hmm. The prayer you say when you use the ritual bath, and then you go back to normal sexual, physical relationship with your husband. That is so, there's no other, I have not encountered in any other religion, no matter how religious they are, that there's anything even vaguely as complicated as that.
What you're referring to are the laws of family purity. That is the euphemism that is generally used. And it is often the case that women have to take a pad or their underwear and send it to the rabbi for an opinion as to whether that's actually blood or not, you know, legally in terms of Jewish law. That is something that I think often surprises even people in the liberal Jewish movements who aren't familiar with that, the extent of particularity of those laws.
So when I was like 25, maybe, I was doing my master's, I have a master's in Jewish studies from the Jewish Theological Seminary. And I was sitting in a class where a text about this came up, and most of the students there had never heard of this. And so the professor sort of described the mikvah and what it's used for and why. And people were like, oh my God, I can't believe people used to do this. And I was sitting there in the class and I raised my hand and I was like, excuse me, but I still do this every month. And it was like total silence. Like, I swear you could have heard the pin drop. Like, the whole class would have turned to face me. And I was like, yeah, really, I do. So I get it. And I will say, Bruce, I very specifically actually try not to use the term the laws of family purity, but nidah, which is the laws of separation, because there's something about calling it family purity that really chafes at me. And there we get to the feminists. So.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you about your forthcoming book, Sex Points. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what you're covering in it?
One of the things I've discovered is that when women have sexual problems, they often think there's something wrong with them. Like there's a light switch, like, Bacheva, please tell me what's wrong. They come in, like the light switch is off. Tell me what's wrong. Is it my relationship? Is it my sense of my body? Is it, I'm too tired? Is it my hormones? Is it the medication I'm on? Just tell me what is wrong, Bacheva, give me that light switch and let's fix it. And my experience has been that the most productive way to look at a sex life is different than that, is to look at it like you need 100 points to have good sex. And those 100 points could come from your physiology, your hormone levels, your medications, your relationship, your sense of yourself, your brain and your ability to fantasize, your knowledge of what to do or what not to do. All of those things are giving you points. And the most effective way to approach a woman's sex life is to say to her, okay, let's take a really good snapshot of everything that's going on and let's see where you're missing points and let's see where we can add points in. So trying to identify that and kind of figure out what are the multi-factors that are affecting your sex life and how to get them going again. So I sort of developed a questionnaire that you take at the beginning, and that hopefully gives you a picture as to where you're missing points. And then the book is primarily an attempt to help women figure out, once they know where their missing points are, where, how can they get those back again? My big bugaboo about the way we approach any kind of problems these days is that we split off the physiological and the emotional, sociological, psychological. Right. Right. Think the brain versus the body. And that drives me nuts, because the brain impacts the body so dramatically and the body is impacting the brain constantly. So if we can look at it as a whole and we can really sort of approach each of those pieces, then we can solve the problem. If we try to solve them independently, I think often it's very tricky.
That's a great segue to something I wanted to make sure to include in this interview, because as sort of a full disclosure for listeners, you were one of the people who read a draft of my book. And I have to say, you were far and away the most helpful person, because in some sense, you tore me a new one. When you got to, and it's kind of perfect, because the chapter that we're doing, just letting listeners know, you haven't heard our little intro section of this podcast where we talk about the chapter that we're talking about. So the chapter we're talking about, this one, is one that we call The Death Spiral for Passion. And it's exactly that chapter where you really took me to task in a way that was tremendously useful. It was particularly about what you just said, because what you were pointing out was, and I'm you know, paraphrasing greatly here, I'm not quoting you, but what I took from what from your comments was, here I am as a psychologist, and I was so privileging the notion that so many problems, particularly involving, well, I use the general term passion, but specifically about sexual passion, I was implying that it was all about anxiety or it was all about relationship, and you were pointing out it's all about a lot of stuff. And I really need to be clear about that. And that was an amazingly helpful critique of the book. And I'm really looking forward to reading your book, because you're going to be describing that. Would you like to comment on that? And then I want to get into a listener question, which really touches on some of the same stuff.
Yeah, first of all, I want to thank you, because I felt bad. You know, I thought your book was great. I thought it was great. You write beautifully. It was really well. The points of your book were really terrific. And I think it can be incredibly helpful. It did hit me on that. What happens is that women come in and sometimes they're at my table sobbing, saying, you know, in this relationship, I really love this man. We always had a great sex life in the last 5 years. It kind of fell apart. And their hormones are in the toilet. And meanwhile, they are convinced that there's a problem with their marriage, you know? I just feel like, you know, sometimes we end up blaming victims almost unintentionally, because because we're looking in the wrong box a little bit, you know, or a woman who comes in who's hysterical because she thinks her marriage is falling apart because she hasn't had an orgasm in the last 3 months. But it turns out, of course, she's now on an SSRI, which it seems like you have to be living under a rock to not realize that could affect your orgasms. But there are people, believe it or not, who it does, you know, who don't know that. So the ability to be able to like parse things out for people is so critical. And the truth is, relationships are honestly a significant part, and you're totally right. Anxiety can be a total buzz killer and people need to address it. And I think that's amazing that you did that in your book. I just also think that we need to kind of approach them from a more holistic perspective sometimes. So that's that's all. And I really appreciate how open you were to my feedback. So,
well, I don't know if this is your experience, but you know, I had a bunch of different people reading it, and many of them were very nice. And it's nice to get nice feedback. But the most useful feedback was the one where somebody said, no, you've got it wrong. You need, you know, you need to address these things. That was incredibly helpful. I hope it's reflected in the final portion of the book. I made significant changes based on your critique.
Yeah, no, definitely. And you know, sometimes people ask you to read things and also they just want you to tell you it's great. So I appreciated that you actually were open to the feedback. So.
Yes, indeed. So, yeah, Judy, you want to introduce the...
Sure. So, you know, as Bruce mentioned, one of the features of our podcast is responding to a listener question. And I think this one is right up your alley. So, Dee writes, Dear Dr. Chalmer, I just finished reading your book, Reigniting the Spark, and if I didn't know better, I'd think you must have a spy in my house. Your couple, Deirdre and Patrick, in the book sound amazingly like me and my husband. I'll call him Pat. I'm 48 and Pat is 50, and we've been married for 25 years. Our youngest child is about to leave for college if the pandemic will allow it. We're almost empty nesters. That should be a time when I get to enjoy life. But everything Pat does annoys me. Dr. Chalmer, we used to be close, but for the past few years I find myself snapping at him over nothing. Our sex life used to be okay, at least I thought so, but as I got closer to menopause, it started to be uncomfortable, and when I would say that to Pat, he would mope so much I figured I should just power through it rather than deal with his reaction. If I let him have sex, it buys me a few days of peace, but I dread those nights. I think Pat is basically a good man, and I don't want to divorce him, but I'm miserable, and I'm pretty sure he is too. What should I do? Okay, Batsheva, you're on.
Oh, my God. I have so many things to say. I could talk for half an hour here. So but I'm not going to do that because it's your podcast. So the first thing I want to say is that what this woman is describing is, I think, also very critical for us to all pay attention to, which is that we come from a society, I think, that really privileges communication and talking over physical reality. So generally speaking, our society says, well, if your relationship is good, the sex will be good, right?
Mm, yeah.
Very rarely do you hear, if the sex is good, then the relationship will be good. But I do think it's a chicken or the egg issue, and that in a good relationship, the sex matters. Like, if you're having sex on a regular basis and the sex is good, then it just changes the tenor of the relationship dramatically. And I feel like we don't pay attention to that. And sometimes when I talk to people, I say, like, what do you think I'm doing with this sex stuff? I'm not that interested in figuring out how to put piece A in slot B. That's not so interesting to me. I'm interested in the relationship that gets created when there's a level of intimacy, sexual intimacy between people. And if I had a nickel for every woman who said to me, she's sitting there, she goes, well, if we've had sex recently and it was pretty good sex and I see his socks on the floor, I just laugh and I scoop them up and I dump them in the hamper. But if we haven't, I want to take the socks and I want to shove them down his throat, right? You got it, right? It's true. Yeah, it's true.
Absolutely.
It sex adds a piece to the relationship that is missing when it's not there. So so I want people to understand that this is the sex part is not just about what happens in the bedroom. It's about the tenor of the relationship. And if you saw that movie, which was, I thought was so well done. Did you see that movie Hope Springs?
I don't think so.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Tonight you have to watch that movie. It's Tommy Lee Jones and Meryl Streep and Tommy Lee Jones. And it's about a couple who hasn't had sex in many years and what has done to the relationship. And it's a little Hollywood. They fix the sex stuff too quickly, but I love that movie because I felt like it did such a good job showing how sex affects the tenor of a relationship, which is really what I think this woman is talking about. So that's number one that I want to say. So number two I want to say is you have to understand that sex is not about intercourse, right? Like that is a huge thing that we need to be talking to our kids about, each other about. Like sex and intercourse are not synonymous. There are a lot of ways to have sex that do not involve putting a penis in a vagina, right? Which when she says it's uncomfortable, I'm gathering from her that her vagina, it hurts now when they have intercourse, which is so common in perimenopause and menopause. So the more you can expand your repertoire to involve, you have a mouth, you have fingers, you have hands, you have toes, you have 100 body parts, you have feathers, you have vibrators, you have toys. There are a million ways to have sex that do not involve intercourse. And I do get that if you're 50 and you haven't really explored that yet, it probably feels awkward. But you know what? Awkward's good too, because sometimes the best sex is early on when things were a little awkward. So stop being so scared of the awkward. It's fun. It's different. It's exploratory. You can have sex without having intercourse. That's item number two that I feel like people need to know.
What you just said about, you know, awkward could be good too. That dovetails, I think, nicely with one of the shticks in my book is that intimacy in general requires not that you reduce anxiety, but that you tolerate it. And sometimes that can be really exciting.
Yes, absolutely. 100%. I think that that is a message I spend so much time talking about. And I think it's so amazing you do it in the book. The third thing I want to say is just very pedestrian, which is, listen, lady, pain is the easiest thing to fix. You just need to find somebody who knows what they're doing. I promise you, if you came in, like sometimes people call me and they have like low desire, they have orgasm problems, they have arousal problems, and those we can help a lot with, but I can't say it's a home run. Menopausal, perimenopausal and menopausal pain is so easy to fix now. There's local estrogen, which is totally safe. It's different from systemic estrogen. That's safe too, but that's a whole other conversation we can have. There are lasers now, so you don't even have to take any medications at all. There's alternative. There's so many easy ways to fix that. So that should be your easiest thing to fix. The fourth thing I'm going to say is that we all of us have to kind of get past this idea that our sex life is static, right? That that we learn how to have sex, and that's the way you have sex, and that's the way you have sex for the rest of your life. That nothing could be further from the truth. The same way you don't exercise the same way as when you were 20 or 30.
Sure.
You know, you have to learn different things. And as your life progresses and as you change life stages with the kids and the body, your needs are going to change. The things you used to be able to do, you may not be able to do, but there's things you can do now that you may not have once been able to. And you will be on medications and your husband may be on some medications and you will face some physical challenges or he will. The more you embrace the fact that you will change and your life is going to change and your sex life has to change along with it, and that with every challenge, there is a solution, the better and wider it opens up the possibility of having a good sex life for the rest of your life. And so we get this crazy notion, you know, Bruce and Judy, I feel like, I don't know where we get sold this bill of goods that, you know, we learn how to have sex and then you have sex like that for the rest of your life. And like, nothing could be further from the truth. Your sex life is just not static.
Well, I think you're right when you said we should be talking to our kids about that from an early age, but there is so little of that going on in terms of parents talking to the kids, because they think if I talk to my kids, that means they're going to go out and have sex. And the sex education that comes about in schools, well, you know, that's kind of a joke. So we're not talking to kids about it. We're not talking to adults about it. We don't say those things, you know, how your sex life changes over a course of time and all the factors that you just brought into the equation. So thank you for bringing that in.
Yeah, we can do a whole other podcast if you'd like about talking to kids about sex, whether your kids are 3 or 10 or 30 or 50. These are messages the kids have to get, and nobody talks about pleasure. And okay, that's a whole other subject. But I will say, if the woman writing in wants to make this better, she really, really can. And she's going to need a little bit of medical help to get her vagina working the way it needs to be working. She's going to need to have some conversations with her husband about maybe expanding the repertoire a little bit and how they're feeling about it and reconnecting. And if they need professional help to have that conversation, that, you know, you guys are available, I'm sure. And she's not facing anything everybody isn't facing at some point. It's just people look at these problems and they think they're insurmountable when really they're little just road bumps. But what is insurmountable is if you don't deal with these problems and then the relationship starts to deteriorate, those problems become way more insurmountable.
Right. Yeah, I often point that out to folks that, you know, that particular, any sort of sex problem can actually be a wonderful opportunity for doing the very thing that we're talking about in terms of expanding your view of what's possible. Yeah, there's a guy, and I'm sure you've heard of him, David Schnarch, who I don't agree with everything he says, but one of the things I enjoy quoting to people or paraphrasing to people is he will often, in giving a talk, he'll ask people, gee, what age do you feel like men and women respectively reach their sexual peak? And the usual answers will be, well, it's usually that, you know, women somewhat older than men, but men it's like 20 and women it's like 40 or something like that. And he says, no, I disagree. Both men and women reach their sexual peak when they're in their 60s and 70s. And he's obviously not talking about sexual gymnastics, or he's not talking about hormone levels, clearly. He's talking about maturity, that even with respect to sexual desire, that it requires a level of maturity to be able to tolerate the anxiety and work with it and really see the opportunities that you can have with maturity that you don't see when you're young.
Yeah, I love David Snark. I think his discussions about, and I think this is also a really good point, and it goes back to the anxiety issue, is learning to be individuals and coming together as two individuals as opposed to merging entirely, and the potency of that. And that goes back to the anxiety, because it's that makes us anxious often.
So are there things you'd like us to be asking you about that we haven't already asked you about? In other words, what else would you like to talk about if you'd like to right now?
One thing I would say to people listening is that, especially as we get older, as we go through our 40s and our 50s, there are medical issues that come up, like for men who are having problems with erections, especially for women whose bodies are changing and having pain or having a harder time getting turned on. Don't underestimate how that can affect you, that the hormonal changes have an impact on you, and that medications you're on have an impact on you. And don't start reading into your relationship, which is something we touched on before, problems that aren't there because you are struggling with some of these physical things. Make sure that you get that checked out. You need to be paying attention to both parts of your relationship, both the communication and the just being able to lower your anxiety level to just be with each other. And you also need to be paying attention to the physiological stuff that's going on. And I do know that it's really hard for people often to find physicians who know what they're doing and are supportive. And I struggle with that, which is largely why I'm writing the book. But if you don't find a physician who you feel like understands this stuff, then I would highly recommend you just keep looking, because they're there. They are there. It's a new field. Sexual health is kind of a new field. There are definitely a lot of quacks in it, so you have to trust yourself. But it's an area where it's really worth putting your time and effort, because in the end, it's really about relationships, as we were talking about. So I do a lot of this stuff. I will say, people are on Facebook or Instagram. I'm more on Instagram than Facebook, even though I'm an old lady. Call myself Instagramma. I'm at Dr. Batsheva, Dr. Batsheva, in terms of putting stuff out there. I do a lot of live segments on pain. I do live segments on, I'm doing one on testosterone actually coming up soon. I save them all. So that, I guess that would be one message I really would want to communicate to people. I guess one other issue, which maybe we're saving for another time that we could talk about, and I would love to hear your thoughts on this as well, is that I feel like many of us are scared of what I'll call the stronger or more complicated emotions, like anger and lust, what I'll call lust rather than love, which we tend to split in our society. We don't do such a great job. And so we've sort of scrubbed clean jealousy, anger, narcissism, objectification. But some of those things are really important for sex. And learning how to reclaim some of that within the certain confines of your sex life and dealing with, I think, the anxiety that promotes is really critical. So I think that's a whole other conversation we may want to have sometime.
Batsheva, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, thank you so much, Batsheva.
You are so welcome. And, you know, I can't wait to come back and we can talk about sex education. We could talk about love versus lust. There's so much to talk about here.
Okay, well, we will have some more conversations with you. This was great. Thank you. That was great. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Dr. Batsheva Marcus. And remember, if you have questions for us that you would like to ask, you can email bruce@brucechalmer.com or visit brucechalmer.com. And who knows, maybe we'll read your question on one of our future podcasts.
And you'll see when you go to brucechalmer.com, we are actually asking you if you'd like to sign up for a time to be interviewed as a guest on the show. So if you have some things you think would be a good fit for the show, we would love to hear from you. And you'll see there's a place where you can actually sign up for a time right there from brucechalmer.com if you go to the podcast tab. So Judy, tell us about our next program.
Yes, next week's topic will be trauma and relationships.
And we have another treat lined up. We've actually already recorded an interview for that show with Rabbi David Edelson, so we hope you'll come and join us for that. And remember, the topics we're using are from my book, Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. And it's available anywhere books are sold.
Until next time, remember, be kind.
Don't panic.
And have faith.